This is tape number 7, Levels of Thinking, Peacemaker. In this part, Len describes the third level of thinking, peacemaker thinking, which is typical of junior high age individuals and a majority of adults in the United States. Refer to peacemakers on handouts number 4, 5, 6, and 7.
So let's talk about peacemakers. Or talk about Earth Mothers, Godfathers, Perfect Pleasers, Nice Guys, Good Girls, Doormats, Saviors, Messiahs. They're all variations on the same theme. What happens to us around junior high age is that we develop third-person perspective in our thinking. We can, for the first time, think about our own thinking. We become consciously reflective. We can think about classes of objects. We can think about steps in a process. We can theorize, theologize, philosophize. We can begin to imagine the possibility of something different. We can sit on the riverbank and watch the river go by. We have great new capacities in our thinking. Our thinking at this stage is what's called uncritical, abstract, logical thinking. We can think abstractly. We can think about our own thinking. But again, there is a condition. And the condition at this stage is that we don't think critically. It doesn't occur to us that we can create our own laws or rules or paradigms or models. Rather, we assume that the truth has already been defined and that people in official positions or with the correct titles or education or degrees, that they have access to the truth. And if we want to know what to do, then we need to go to those people and ask for advice or ask for permission. And then they tell us how we should live and who we should be. And our job then is to live up to the standards. It's to live up to the expectations. This is a stage of perfectionism where people have lots of shoulds and oughts about how they should be, what they ought to do. And they try to continually live up to those standards. And they become self-righteous or indignant when people don't live up to their standards. The power of this stage is that people have more of a historical perspective. They can do analysis. They can do planning. They can do lots of things they couldn't do before. The limitation is that they tend to maintain tradition. Their time focus is on maintaining the past and the present, that they assume there are right ways of doing things, the ways it's been done in the past. And they focus more on maintaining that tradition than on sometimes doing what really needs to be done. They're more likely to follow the rules than to be creative and innovative. They're more likely to follow tradition than to take risks. They will do what authority tells them to do rather than challenge authority. They're more likely to say, well, who do you want me to be? What do you want me to do? Just tell me what you want. One of the sources of conflict for people in this stage of their thinking, when they're in this stage of thinking, is that they get caught between competing expectations of different sources of authority in their life. So how do I keep my parents and my spouse and my employer and my religious leader and my kids and my friends all happy at the same time? It's hard to live up to everybody's expectations of us. In my relationships with others, because I have third-person perspective, because I can sort of step outside of myself, I am also able to step inside of others in ways that I haven't been able to before. I begin to develop a more significant capacity for empathy, to actually know what it feels like inside others. And consequently, I develop a capacity for intimacy, because intimacy depends on empathy. That's why junior high age kids are falling in love every day. They're trying out their new capacity. Whatever age you are, every time that you fall in love with somebody else, you're probably about 13. A dimension of this, of relationships and this level of thinking, is that I not only know what it's like inside of others, I not only have empathy with others, but I begin to realize that other people know what it's like inside of me. So I'm not only more conscious, I become more self-conscious. And consequently, I begin worrying about what other people think. I become embarrassed easily. So why girls giggle at this age and boys decide to start taking showers. They're aware of how other people perceive them. And their primary criteria for their worth and value oftentimes becomes, what do they need to do to look good to others? What do they need to do to please others? It becomes important that everyone likes them and that no one looks down upon them or doesn't approve of them. So this issue of worrying about what others think becomes a guiding principle that oftentimes I get caught between what I believe I should do and worried about what I need to do to not look embarrassing in front of others. Relationships at this stage become interpersonal. People focus on developing interpersonal relationships because they have this new capacity for intimacy. But intimate relationships at this stage have a static quality to them. They tend to be characterized by possessiveness, by jealousy, by ownership. He's my man, she's my woman. In a traditionally peacemaker culture in the United States, you know, up until the 60s, women wouldn't think of not giving up their last name when they married someone. But as we've seen, because of the kind of cultural revolution we've gone through in the 60s, where a large number of people have moved out of this level of thinking, what we find are a lot of women keeping their own names or having hyphenated names. It's characteristic of shifts in their levels of thinking. As peacemakers, we don't question our rights. We don't question our role. And we've seen that women traditionally have been in a peacemaker role in our culture. And again, that especially was true up until the mid-60s, where that began changing as all the rights movements developed in the response to Vietnam and Second Vatican Council in organized religions. So we've seen is a shift in many ways culturally in the Western world out of this level of thinking. But for anybody over the age of 35 or so, they very much grew up in a peacemaker culture where people did what was right. You hear people talk about doing what's right. They look for the right answer. They oftentimes won't act or become indecisive because they're afraid they'll make the wrong decision. They won't find the right answer. There's an assumption that there's one right thing to do. Another characteristic of relationships in this stage is a pattern that I call the love test syndrome. And the love test syndrome works in personal relationships and it's operative in business professional relationships as well. And the pattern is that people move into a relationship and they anticipate what other people expect of them. And then they try to meet and exceed those expectations. However, all of this meeting of expectations and time turns out not to be free. So to meet your expectations, I may work overtime. I may deny what I need. I may always be nice with you, never express my anger, say yes when I want to say no, always accommodate you, not think for myself, sacrifice in any way I can, take care of you, whatever it takes to please you. However, at some point, I decide to set up the secret love test. After all I've done for you, you should know, you should be able to read my mind and know that I'm lonely, that I want you to take the kids, that I want you to walk in and tell me what a great job I've done, that I want a bonus, I want you to offer me time off, I want the corner office, I want a surprise birthday party. Poor silly fool that you are, you always fail to recognize that this one was the test. And because you fail to realize after all I've done for you, I then get sneakily angry. Now, peacemakers can't get angry because they can't afford to have anybody angry back at them. But they can get sneaky angry. And they get sneaky angry by getting hurt, used, disappointed, or betrayed. Whenever you hear people talking about being hurt, used, disappointed, or betrayed, you know that they've been in this peacemaker pattern of setting up secret love tests, and they're sliding back into being a scorekeeper to find some sneaky way to make the other person pay for it. And if that doesn't work, they'll just go back to stage one and let them have it. I think this has been, in many ways, the model of American marriage. and of a lot of corporate life. My parents will forgive me. Let me tell a story on them and me that happened a few years ago where I had come back from a trip to Europe with my sons, and I had stopped off to visit my parents on the way back, and we're sitting in the backyard. It's summertime, and my mother says, in a indirect peacemaker kind of way, you know, if I were to win the lottery before I died, you know, I'd really like to see Paris. So I said to her, would you like to go to Paris? Oh, no, honey, that'd be too much. Now, it's a typical peacemaker response of denying our own needs, of denying what we legitimately want and have a right to. So I turned to my dad, who was sitting there, and I said, do you ever think about going back and finding your grandfather's farm in France? He says, nope, never thought of that. I said, well, would you like to do that? Sure, sounds like fun. So I turned to my mother and said, well, Dad and I are going to France. Would you like to go with us in October? So we ended up going to France together. And we had actually a great week in a lot of ways. We spent time in Paris, and we drove over to the Alsace region, and we, in fact, found our family farm and had dinner there. And at the end of our trip, the last day, we were back in Paris, and we were making it sort of a Monet day. We'd been to Mass at Notre Dame, and we'd gone to one of the museums and seen his panels, and we'd gone out to Giverny and visited his ponds and driven on to Rouen. Now, there are a couple of factors about my parents. At this point, when we made this trip, they were like in their mid-70s. My father had been retired for several years and was a pretty content person. He had had some health problems. He has some circulation problems. He can't walk very far, and he sometimes has problems with his stomach, and so he doesn't like to eat greasy food, and he likes to eat early so he can go to bed early because he wears out during the day. He tends to go to bed early and get up early. My mother, on the other hand, who has spent most of her life taking care of everybody around her, in very generous and unselfish ways, who has not done a lot for herself, who has denied herself a lot. At this point in her life, she's not quite so content. She's feeling some restlessness. She still wants to do things she hasn't done. She has some feeling that maybe she's missed out on some things and she wants to make up for it. So she still works full time, and she's very busy and involved in lots of things. And I suspected that she wanted something magical to happen on this trip, as I often have in life, something to make up for whatever we haven't done or haven't gotten. So it's her last, so this is who we are, and I'm their son, and my job oftentimes has been to communicate between them, because they haven't always communicated directly between themselves. So it's her last day, and we're heading back to Paris from Rouen. It's a Sunday afternoon. It's about 3 o'clock, and it's sunny and kind of crisp outside. And I'm driving. My dad's in the front seat, and my dad turns around to my mother and says, "Mars, are you hungry?" And with some irritation in her voice, she says, "No, Leonard, I'm not hungry." And I notice the irritation in her voice. He doesn't seem to notice it, and I'm also aware that she doesn't do what she would normally do, which is to say, "Leonard, are you hungry?" Because my mother has spent 50-some years taking good care of him and getting up in the morning and saying, what do you need? What do you want? And pretty much providing it for him. And I'm aware she didn't ask the question. So I look in the rearview mirror, and I see her looking out of her side window in the back, and she's kind of mumbling to herself. And I wonder if she's mumbling what she wishes she would have said that she didn't say. I have a pretty good idea, I think, of what she really wants. That my guess is, on her last night, she'd like to go back to Paris and find some really nice, romantic place to go out to dinner and to wear the new clothes she had bought and to have some music and have some dancing and have a great celebration for the last night of our vacation. But I suspected that my dad wasn't aware of that. And what he was more focused on was, where was he going to be able to eat early enough that he'd be able to get to bed? So we drive on for a ways, and my father turns to me and says, "Well, Lando, are you hungry?" And I said, "No, I'm not hungry either." But I decide to play both sides of that conversation. I say, "So, Dad, are you hungry?" oh no, I'm not hungry. Again, if she's not hungry and I'm not hungry, he can't be hungry. Those are the peacemaker rules. And my mother now pipes up from the back seat her common self-sacrificing line, which is, not, it doesn't matter to me. You two just do whatever you want to do. Now, I suspect that if she were really honest with herself, that's not totally true. I suspect if she were really honest, she'd say, you know, what I'd like to do tonight is I'd like to find some really nice place where I can get dressed up for our last night in Paris. But she doesn't say that. Peacemakers aren't allowed to say what they really want. Their job is to take care of everybody else. And that's pretty much what she's always done. So we go on a little while longer, and my dad says, well, what are we going to do about dinner? Well, I've been thinking. So I said, well, seems to me we have three options. We can either stop at one of those awful roadside cafeterias, the cafeterias that are built over the freeways. I said, but, you know, the food's not too good and it may bother your stomach. So that's probably not a real good option. I figured I'd eliminated that one. I said, or when we get back into Paris, it's going to be about 5 o'clock, and we could try to find some place to eat then. The difficulties are that traffic's going to be heavy, and the restaurants don't open until 7, and we may have a difficult time finding a place open, and you might have to, you know, not only is that going to be a hassle to try to drive around, but you may have to walk, and, you know, you have trouble walking very far. I said, or our third option would be to go back to the hotel, take a nap, which is what I really wanted to do, but I wasn't being honest about. And we could get up at 7 and then take a cab to some place that we had selected where we could have a nice romantic evening for our last night in Paris. Figured I had it all wrapped up. My mother now pipes up in the back seat and once again says, well, it doesn't matter to me. You two do whatever you want to do. And my dad, taking her literally, taking her at face value, says, well, I think Mars would enjoy eating at one of those roadside cafeterias. She ain't never done that before. Whereupon Marcella, contrary to how she normally is, kind of did a little eruption and said, I don't know why you think you have to eat at 4:30. You ate at 9 o'clock last night, and you digested your food just fine. That whole scenario is just typical of what happens in peacemaker relationships, where nobody says directly what they want, what they need. Everybody is trying to take care of everybody else. And ultimately, nobody gets what they really want. And people feel irritated and cheated afterwards. Probably wondering what we did. Well, in fact, we stopped at one of those roadside cafeterias, and we talked about the conversation that had taken place between us. And I said, you know, I really don't want to decide that for you. I'd like for you to decide what you want to do. And I personally would like to go out to eat later. And as it turned out, as we were driving back into Paris, my dad spotted a place that was open and said, I'd really like to stop there and eat for myself, and why don't the two of you go out later? And that's what we did. So I didn't get my nap, but everybody more or less got what they wanted for dinner that night. I invite you to be aware of your own relationships. Who do you accommodate? Who do you not really tell what you need? Who do you believe that you have to take care of? You know, part of peacemaker relationships is playing ostrich when it comes to any conflict. That we deny it, we placate others, we apologize first, we do anything we can to make it go away. We have endless cliches of let's let sleeping dogs lie, let's not open Pandora's box, let's let the dust settle, time will take care of it, anger just makes it worse. And what we're doing is avoiding. We live in the myth that to be honest with other people in this stage is somehow going to hurt them. Being honest with other people does not hurt them. Being dishonest hurts them. Not saying what's true hurts them. Or saying what's true in disrespectful, hurtful ways hurts people. But anytime I'm willing to say the truth and say it with care or respect, that is not hurtful. Peacemakers confuse that. They assume that to say the truth is somehow going to, quote, hurt somebody's feelings. What they're really saying is that they're afraid that somebody's going to be angry with them or not approve of them. So, with whom do you avoid conflict? With whom do you get into your cliches? When do you walk around it? When you really need to address what's really going on with others. At this stage, our power lies in socially sanctioned authority. Because our thinking is uncritical, because we assume that truth lies outside of us, because we assume that people in official positions have access to the truth, then we look to them for advice and for permission. Power at this stage also resides in our ability to make other people feel guilty and obligated because we've been nice to them or taken care of them. One of the ways I know instantly when I'm in this stage is when I'm worrying about what somebody else thinks, or when I'm feeling embarrassed, or when I'm feeling duty-bound or guilty and obligated and not free to do what I really need to do on my own. My needs at this stage are for approval. I need everybody to like me. I need acceptance. It's important where I live and what I drive and how I dress and where I went to school. At this stage, I'll tend to join organizations characterized by interpersonal relationships and organizations in which I can have a significant role to play. Certain types of organizations traditionally have tended to be peacemaker type organizations. I think this is tend to be true of some government bureaucracies. It has tended to be true of healthcare organizations, of mainline religious organizations. It's tended to be true of financial industry. I suspect it's one of the reasons why banks have so many levels of vice presidents, because status and titles are important when we're in this level of thinking. Our moral criteria at this stage is to do what's going to be acceptable. It's to live up to the standards. It's to meet the approval of whoever the authorities are in our life. And again, it becomes a source of conflict for us because oftentimes we have conflicting sources of authority in our life. And how do we keep all those sources happy at the same time? So a question that comes up for us is, so how do I deal with peacemakers effectively? What do I do with myself when I find myself here? And what do I do with others when they're here? I need to remind myself that sometimes doing what's right is not exactly the same as doing what needs to be done. That sometimes holding on to the past, simply maintaining tradition, never takes us into the future. It's safe, it's familiar, it's comfortable. And there is tradition that we need to maintain. But I need to also know when to let go and when to move on and when to try something new. I also need to know when to respectfully address my issues with authority. And I need to know when I need to be addressing my issues directly with other people. As I find myself in encounters needing to deal with other people who are in this level of thinking, I need to remind myself that because someone is nice does not mean that they are fragile or delicate or helpless. Being nice is a way of being in the world. It has nothing to do with my strength. I need to be aware that I don't kid myself into avoiding addressing what I need to address with someone because I'm, quote, afraid of hurting their feelings. I need to say what's true, and I need to say it with respect. Also, in dealing with people in this stage, I frequently need to be persistent because they go away, they disappear in their niceness, and they'll tend to deny there's any problem. Oh no, let's just let this pass. Let's forget about it. It's not that big a deal. It doesn't bother me. I've got broad shoulders. No, let's just forget it. Problem is that it's usually not forgotten, and sometimes it is a big deal, and I don't always like the price I pay for it down the road because I let them sneak away or disappear in their niceness now. So it's important that you be persistent, that you be willing to, in fact, really address the issue, that I be willing to say to the person, I know it may be uncomfortable to talk about it, but we need to talk about it. And it may not be a problem for you, but what I'm telling you is it's a problem for me, and I need for you to hear that. It'd be easier in the moment, short term, to just let it go. But the fact is, that's not going to go away. So I want to address it, and I'd like to address it now. And I'm wondering what you need to be willing to do that with me. We need to, in respectful, caring ways, firmly address what we need to address when we need to address it with others. As with the other levels of thinking, there is an application worksheet that you can use to reflect on and integrate when you are in this level of thinking and when you observe others in it. In your handbook, it's worksheet 13, and it is similar to the exercise you've done for the previous levels of thinking.
This is the end of tape 7.